Blog Talk Radio.
Dedicate our lives to this sport. We give, we do thousands of sit-ups in camp. We run hundreds of miles, you know, for the ones that take it serious. And we just dedicate ourselves fully to our craft, man. We watch tape. We you know, we attitude. We moody, and we go into that fight and to land on the line.
Basketball fans, the NBA Playoffs Banter Podcast returns to talk everything that is the NBA Playoffs. And obviously, we got spoiled with 2 7-game series. That's very, what was it, 19, I think it was, I believe it was 1977 was the last time the East and the West, both of them, got extended to 7. So we are going to start here very quickly with the recap. I'm just waiting for my co-host to call in. He should be calling in any moment. So we'll start with some recap from the Game 7s. You know, we did a show on Saturday, so we won't spend a ton of time on the Game 7s, but we will talk about the Game 7s. And then we're going to preview and predict the NBA Finals, and it's not going to be a really long show. To probably be one of our shortest shows in quite some time, because to be honest with you, there's only so many things that you can break down when it comes to this series. You know, we already talked about how, you know, most people think that the NBA Finals took place. They just happen to take place in the Western Conference. And that's, if you think about it, that's really, it's not that new. You know what I mean? It really isn't. I mean, for years, you know, the East has won some championships, don't get me wrong, and having LeBron at Miami won them too, and we know the Cleveland one that he came back, you know, with and all that, but I don't know. It's just one of those things, you know. If you couldn't get it done, what the hell? Okay. Weird. So I'm hoping my co-host calls in here any moment. He just texted me, but I'm not sure. Huh. All right, we'll see. Anyway, if this is your first, like I said, we'll break it down. It just, you know, last year, not many people gave Cleveland a shot for obvious reasons, you know. Ever since the summer of 2016, when Kevin Durant, you know, joined his arch rival. No, ever since he joined them, you basically knew, barring major injury, that it's a wrap. You know what I mean? And so it we're only going to break it down so much. But anyway, if this is your first time listening to the NBA Playoffs Banter Podcast, stay with us all the way through these NBA Finals. We'll also have 2 more shows after that. One will be focused in on the NBA draft. And then, of course, early July, which, based off how many, you know, big names and potential trades, actually, not that they have to, you know, happen. Sometimes they happen right at the draft, though, right, obviously. But early July, maybe mid-July, who knows, but we will be doing a NBA free agency show as well. And so we've been doing this on a weekly basis. Like I said, if this is your first time listening to it, we do the NBA playoffs, but we also do the college ball show. So it starts with college football late August, goes all the way to the national championship in January. We change to college basketball, take that to the national championship. And then in April, since we're already on college basketball, We figure if you like college basketball more than the NBA, then the odds are, though, you like the NBA playoffs. You know what I mean? So we do that all the way, like I said, till early July. Then we take a little bit of hiatus anyway. But it's all under the Rope-A-Dope Radio Podcast. It can be found. We live stream it right here, blogtalkradio.com/Rope-A-Dope Radio. So it live streams. And it archives. It's basically like the headquarters, but you can check us out on iTunes under the Rope-A-Dope Radio Podcast. Player FM is a great source. Stitcher, Spreaker, TuneIn. Through TuneIn, you can actually stream us live on Spotify. We're also part of the Grueling Truth Sports Podcast Network, which is available everywhere, including iHeartRadio. Head on over to thegruelingtruth.net. That's thegruelingtruth.net. They got a great sponsor over there, mybookie.ag. That's mybookie.ag. So let's get into the nitty-gritty. Obviously, I do see my co-host online now, so we're going to kind of start breaking some of this stuff down. So obviously, we're kind of off of, since the last time we spoke, that was Saturday, we're coming off of two game sevens. And we kind of assumed that Sunday and Monday would reflect that, right? That this would be the time that we get to these two game sevens. And we did get spoiled considering, if you think about it. You know what I mean? You don't get this type of thing happening, you know? And it's kind of crazy as far as the finals go, though. 4 years in a row, it's the first time. And this is a, when you say first time in history, it's not just NBA history. Not that I'm trying to overhype these finals by any stretch, but it is kind of an interesting statistic. It's the first time all across major team sports, professional team sports, I should say, that the same two teams met four consecutive years, whether it's a title game or, you know, a title series, the finals, whatever it is, whatever sport it is. You know, obviously NFL is just a one-and-done type thing as far as their playoff. They can't really play seven games, can they? But that's kind of crazy. That is pretty crazy. But as we know, the matchup is nowhere near as interesting as it was, say, 2 years ago. And even heading into last year, the writing was on the wall. But before we, you know, break that down, let's get into some of the recap anyway. You know, from the East side of things, it was kind of a weird game. It's kind of a strange game. Boston actually started out decently. You know, they didn't come out shrunk in the moment. I mean, they were at home, but they did have some young players that hadn't had that experience compared to Cleveland, that's for sure. But, you know, it's kind of crazy if you look at the numbers from both sides of the losing sides, I should say, from the East and the West. If you look at the numbers from three-point land, it's pretty crazy. And this is one of those things that kind of stand out. Some of the purists or old school basketball fans. I'm bringing my co-host in just a second here. Thanks, Marshall, for calling in today on a random day. But I don't know. It's kind of weird, like how bad both of the teams shot. And if for someone who's, like I mentioned, a purist or not a purist, I'm not actually a purist, but for someone that's more old school anyway, that was watching in the 80s and 90s, sometimes you look at these pull-up threes and you look at certain, you could just see an easy bucket go by time and time again. And although the NBA has moved to this system, you know, or this style of play, and overall it's improved the play, a lot of that had to do with rule change as well, and what kind of players are, you know, being drafted in the league and the skill sets that they have. But one of the biggest problems that we say maybe in college basketball, when a team depends so much on threes, and a lot of these teams, all three of these teams, I should say all four of the teams that were in, you know, the semifinals, basically, both sides of the conference's finals, they rely on threes. And now you can, you know, we can talk about who relies on more, sure, no doubt. I mean, Houston obviously leads the pack. But the fact that all these teams are reliant on the three so much, you know, there, not long ago, you wouldn't find too many players that would get to 8 and 10 and 12 three-pointers in a game, period. But let alone a game that they're struggling in, or even shooting 13 threes or 15 threes or 17 threes, even over a two-game stretch where you're 3-17, let's say. Even that's like, come on, dude, but to do it in one game, and like I said, a lot of it, I'm not trying to sound too old here, guys, but a lot of it is just that's what we're dealing with. But the problem with that three-point percentage in that shot in general is if you're hitting it at a 40% clip as a team, you're killing it as a team. You'd be killing it if you're shooting 40%. But even as a player, especially in the playoffs when defense steps up more, as a player, you know, I don't know. It just seems like, I guess my point is, I can keep going on, but it just seems like, guys, there's got to be a different shot out there. But you are built to do what you're built to do, right? And that's why you have four out of the five guys a lot of times. And sometimes all five guys that can shoot from the outside. But when you're relying on a percentage that's like 10 to potentially 15% lower than a normal shooting percentage, that's going to cause high scoring because you're taking so many and the threes will land. But when they don't, it could just be ugly. And I think really in both sides at times in these playoffs, you could really, it was just like, all right, guys, let's do something else. But as far as the east side of the thing goes, I mean, there was a point where they were combined, Cleveland and Boston, 7 for 42, which is 17%. Like I said, though, Boston had the early lead. I think they were up. I think they got it to like 11 or I can't remember. But it did kind of look like, man, Cavs better get this thing going. But I think the largest deficit was 12, now that I'm looking at some stats here. And Cleveland took their first lead with 4:46 in the third. First lead since leading 18-17 in the first quarter. You know what I mean? So it started out kind of like, okay, here we are. Boston kind of stretched it out a little bit, and then Cleveland came back. And by the time they came all the way back, and they took over the game. Now, there was times when, you know, there was moments when you thought, all right, dude, it's a seven-point game. Here we go. They're going to be able to do this. But it just didn't go their way, basically. But it was a good game all the way down to the wire. 35-15-9 for Mr. LeBron James. And like I said, when you look at his eliminator game or what he's averaging, you know, it's just silly. Anytime you could put, you know, measure up to Jordan stats or surpass Jordan stats, you're saying something. So LeBron becomes the sixth player in NBA history to play in eight different finals. But, yeah, the outside shooting from both. And then finally, JR, a couple other guys started, and LeBron actually, started hitting threes. And that was the difference of the game, the little mini cushion that they had, you know, been able to earn Cleveland, kept them, you know, safe. But it was just a couple of threes that finally went in for one of the sides. And that one side had a little bit of cushion, too. And they had the best player in the world. That didn't hurt. But LeBron could have had probably 15, 16 assists. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and bring in my co-host. My switchboard was a little missed up there, so I had to buy some time, Marshall. What's going on, Marshall? How you doing, buddy?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, man. I'm doing pretty good. Hopefully, like I said, the switchboard doesn't act up, but it really doesn't matter. Now that I got you unmuted, it could freeze, it could do anything, and we're good to go that way. But I don't want to spend a ton of time on recap, per se, because we are talking, you know, Sunday and Monday. But just talking about the east side of things before we get to the west side of things. The three-point shot couldn't land for either side. Like I said, at some point they were combined 7 for 42. Finally, though, J.R. Smith, like I mentioned, a couple other threes started falling on the other side. Not a ton, mind you, but just enough for Cleveland. So Cleveland got the job done in a game 7. LeBron just putting up crazy numbers. He didn't get to 40, Marshall, but if you look at the overall score, I mean, that's damn near a 50-point game. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he basically was kind of just like the quarterback for them for the whole game. I mean, I can't even say when he took a time off because he played the entire game, which I think says enough in itself. Just the guy was tremendous. He brought the ball up and down the court. He always kept the team under control. He played the game at a slower pace for him, which I think he knew in his head he had to do. There was a couple plays in possessions where he'd maybe step off to the side, or his defense stepped up when he had to. But you could tell he kind of like calculated like the whole game kind of in his head, because he had to know himself that if I go sit down on the bench for 2 minutes, my team could be in a world of hurt. So it was just like a strong mental performance, obviously a strong physical performance. He had an incredible block, which he seems to have almost all the time now in elimination games. Going back to that time when they beat the Warriors and Iguodala, that one against Rozier. The dude just does everything. There was a couple of plays in the game where I was telling my friend, I don't know how he makes the passes he does. I mean, from the time he's been an NBA player, he's always been a great passer. But there was a couple of plays in the game where he was literally passing the ball, and it's like the teammate was like, oh, crap, he just saw 2 seconds about ahead of what I'm about to do. He drove to the lane one time and threw a pass to where Jeff Green was moving to. And it's like, and the pass went between like 2 defenders. I'm like, how do you see where your teammate's going to be with 2 defenders in the way between you and the pass, and then he hits the shot? It's just his vision. I mean, everything was just beautiful about the game. Obviously, he couldn't get into foul trouble. He didn't do that. I thought one of the key points of the game was when Tatum chest bumped him. And I get that as a rookie, you know, he was flying high and everything, but it's like, dude, you really probably didn't need to do that. Like, why are you going to even poke the bear? And after that, Tatum hit one more shot, and Boston had the lead, but then after that, it was done. I think LeBron would ISO on Tatum for about 3 or 4 times in a row. Tatum kept committing fouls. LeBron kept scoring. After the chest bump, it was kind of like, I mean, maybe, you know, LeBron wants to win, but it's like, dude, you really probably didn't
piss him off. It was a deserved chest bump, though, if we're being honest. If you're a rookie and you just slam dunked, and I wanted to go old school on that, slam dunked, if you literally just did what you did to LeBron, though, I mean, you have to kind of half chest bump. You have to at least shoulder shrug him. You have to at least bump his shoulder or something. That was disgusting. And then he came back and hit that 3. I was like, oh, shit, dude. Boston's going to win this game now, you know?
Yeah, a rookie doing it. I know he's riding high, but
I was like,
probably wasn't the smartest thing. But again, to come down the stretch, LeBron had the outlet pass when Boston was getting near the end and they made an extra foul. Or when LeBron went down to like add on to the lead and like Marcus or one of the Morris brothers, I always get the names confused, but one of the Morris brothers tried to pull his shoulders down and he still made the layup after it was goaltended and just kind of screamed across the court. He just did what you had to do. But to rip Boston a little bit, they blew this game. For all the compliments they got all year, for a team that was undefeated for the whole playoffs, for a team that had the better players on the court besides LeBron, I don't get why they all of a sudden tried to spin it like, oh, we had a great year, and you know we have Kyrie and Hayward coming back. It's like, nah, dude, even Brad Stevens is like, he didn't even take blame himself. He's like, LeBron's done this year after year. I give the man credit. It's like, what about all this hype we've heard about Rozier and Tatum and Brown, and you blew it on your home court? Why? I just thought that he could have maybe said the, you know what, props to LeBron, but we should have won this game. I mean, Jeff Green was the second biggest factor for your playoff game that cost your team a loss. And you're just going to come out and say, well, LeBron's LeBron, and I just can't believe the run he's on. He should have said, no, dude, my players didn't step up when they had to. I mean, Tatum had a good game, but Rozier was 0 for 10 from 3. That's pitiful. Marcus Smart, where was he? Horford bricked an open 3 that could have been clutched down the stretch. Morris, I don't get how we gave them so much credit throughout the year, and we're on this magical run, and they're undefeated at home, and LeBron's whole team is sucks besides him, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, we're just going to applaud them. It's like, no, dude, take credit that you lost. I view it that way, Chris, because, again, Jeff Green, a guy that's been basically kicked off NBA franchises for never really being a clutch player and making money than cashing it in, was your second leading scorer. You can't tell me that Jaylen Brown and Marcus Smart and Morris and all these guys are, like, supposed to not be the equivalent to Jeff Green. So, Stevens, like, the dude got praised the entire season. You couldn't have maybe drawn up some different plays or done something to make your team drive into the lane? I'm complimenting LeBron first, but I think Boston deserved to be ripped too because they were expected to win. And the way that first half started, Chris, or the first quarter, it basically looked like, oh man, what? I know LeBron's doing all he can, but who does he have to throw the ball to? So I guess that's my opinion. If I was maybe a top ESPN person, I would have maybe given a little bit of that spin because you can't compliment a team all year and then just flip the script and just give LeBron credit after.
Well, I don't know if it was all year long. It was early, then it kind of fell off, whatever. But I think most of it has to do with the last chunk of time and what they've done without their guys, you know, their mm-hmm. two best players. Anytime you go to a conference final, push it to game 7, and you don't have your two best players, you're going to get a ton of love, nationally especially. So I do see what you're saying. It did seem like they were the better team on the court, talent for talent. If you take in, you know, whatever, 8-9 guys worth or six
sure.
top six players or whatever. Yeah, I get you there, no doubt about it. And some of that, like you said, is coaching too because it's like, all right, guys, the three's not falling, so we got to do something else. You know what I mean? But you're right. Yeah, you're right. They do deserve some blame in here or, you know, saying, hey, what the hell? You were favored at home. Why didn't you get the job done? So I hear you there, but as far as praise for the team and the coach, anytime you get there without your top two guys, I think it's just seeing what's going to be, you know, like, wow, this is nuts. I mean, look at how much, you know, look at how much Philly got in a short amount, you know, with that the way they ended. Basically, like, since the break, the All-Star break, after that, Philly was like one of the hottest teams. And they obviously came in on that, whatever it was, 16 in a row or whatever. So they got a ton of praise because you just looked at what they were going to be, and that obviously quieted up pretty quick, you know, because everybody had them in the finals, you know, going into round 2. In my mind, I got to believe that they were the favorite at that time too, to be honest anyway. But, yeah, I hear you. They do – you still got to break down what happened in an actual game and not look to the future so much because you never know with Kyrie's injury. You know, you never know if he'll be back 100% for the next several years in a row. Not for next year, I'm saying, in general. But, yeah, I think that most of the hype came from the fact that they're doing this, you know. And I will say that the things that they got established this year and the core that Boston has, it is pretty silly. And they – potentially, if it all blends right, and if you look at that starting lineup, what it could be, like I said, if it blends right, and how strong they could be defensively, even stronger, you know, with one of their players that focuses on defense, no doubt. But the other one's just okay. I'm talking about Kyrie, of course, there. But they're going to be something, you know, to be reckoned with, no doubt about it. But, yeah, I hear you. I definitely hear you. Sometimes and I think sometimes people are softer on people or whatever because maybe LeBron steals the story. One, sure, okay. Two,
sure.
The future, what they got in the future, oh, you know, they can be kind of satisfied with that type of thing, like, hey, man, next year's going to be awesome. But yes, sometimes the experts praise people so much that then all of a sudden they can't. Since I pray, it happens in boxing all the time. They want to say, oh God, that was a really tight fight. No, it's just a competitive fight that you thought was giving me a mismatch. So you end up giving extra rounds to the other guy because you were wrong. Why don't you just admit you were wrong? It's no big deal. Get over it. You know what I mean? So I even heard like Stephen A. Smith saying such stubborn stuff like, and him and Max will say stuff where you're like, what? But that's their show. That's their show.
Yeah.
That's what they're supposed to. They're supposed to do that. But you know, to say like we'll get into this next series. Chris Paul wouldn't have had anything to do with Game 7, so it doesn't even matter that he played. It's like, dude. Like, come on, man.
Yeah.
Like, really? So he'd have nothing? He would make not even a 1% difference in a potential outcome in Game 6 and Game 7, but especially Game 7, if he was healthy? You don't think he'd do? I mean, talk about a guy that has basically the only guy that has a mid-range jumper damn near in the series. No, I mean, Curry and Durant have one. But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, in the NBA, there's not a ton of guys that can get off the dribble and have a mid-range jumper. Funny, Westbrook actually can do that. But it's like, dude, when they needed a dude to be like, these next 3 minutes, I'm going to keep us in this game because I'm going to get off the dribble. I'm going to stop at, like, 13 feet, pull up. I don't have to go all the way to the rack. I don't have to hit these three. I don't have to drive and dish every time. I can just say, nah, screw this. You know what I mean? I'm going to get some buckets or whatever. And that, let's bring it to the West when
yeah.
it comes to that, just to kind of get through this here. You know, I mean, the Rockets, once again, surprisingly to me, especially without Chris Paul, got off to another great start. And most of it had to do, in my opinion, defensively. Of course, they were hitting some shots, don't get me wrong. Neither team was lighting up the scoreboard per se, of course, but there was a couple stats that stood out to me, and then I'll kind of pass it to you as we get into this, you know, breaking down this gaming, then we'll get to the finals and whatnot. And part of the reason why we're spending time on these games is because, let's face it, there's not a ton to break down when it comes to the finals, besides, like, historical facts and stuff like that. But so I'm looking at a time mark, 5 minutes left to go in the first half. Houston's up 44-33. So that's a pretty good amount of offense right there, considering they have over 5 minutes left. But at that point, this was a key in the first chunk of the game. The Rockets, at that point, had 10 offensive rebounds to the Warriors' 4. That was one thing that really stood out to me, like, okay, they keep – and that also goes back to those long, unpredictable rebounds from all these damn threes. There was another stat that stood out to me, and I think this is the biggest lead they had, 48-33. I think they stretched it out to 15, and that was just a little bit later than the time we just marked, and the Rockets had 9 steals compared to 4 steals. So to me, the defense was just there. And then, Marshall, the points in the paint, getting to the rack, and points in the paint still means a ton just because nowadays you're not always putting it in. And if you're putting it in, it's probably to a small forward when you're putting the ball into the post. But it's still just points in the post, and obviously getting to the rack's huge. At that point, you're looking at it, and this is a handful of minutes later, still with an 11-point lead, like a minute left to go, 22-6 on points in the paint. So it was like not only defense, their offense is – I should say not only offense, they were clicking pretty well there, or good enough getting open shots and whatnot. But the defense was making it really, really hard. And once again, just like game six, there was this funk. And then that third quarter came, and that's where I think Chris Paul would have been able to potentially, I'd never talk about what would have happened. Oh, this would have happened. No, we don't know. We have no clue. But even 80% Chris Paul could have helped them in that third quarter again and down the stretch in the fourth quarter. But as we know, 27 straight 3 points missed. They went on a stretch of 1 of 28, but 27 in a row. Coming off what Boston did, Marshall, from three-point land in the night before, it really kind of was like put it into place where you're like, oh, my God, how many threes can we take here, guys? And that's, like I said, where I think Mr. Midrange could have done something in Chris Paul right there and just calmed shit down a little bit. But that third quarter has been money for them basically all year. I'm talking about Golden State. They got it done, and although they didn't maybe put it away quite like they did in Game 6, you know, to where they – you know, got it to 19 and that kind of stuff. That third quarter and then into the fourth, man, they just found it and just ran with it. And, you know, Houston couldn't hit an outside shot.
I think the main reason or one of the reasons that happened is because those guys were dog tired. Obviously,
right.
As a coach, you really only want to play your best people, but he was seven deep the entire series. And I mean, it's just basketball 101. When your legs start to go, your shots go too. I mean, if you put NBA guys in an open gym and just say, hey, start chucking up threes, they're going to hit a good chunk of them. And a lot of the threes that they shot in the game for Houston were pretty good looks, but they kept missing them. And I think from a Golden State perspective, it's like, okay, guys, they're getting tired. They're chucking up bad shots. I guess you almost, at that point, maybe – want to fall back a little bit and try to protect the rim for a layup. I mean, it's hard to fathom those numbers happen, but the main reason I think they happened was not because of defense, just because people are tired. I mean, the same dudes got tired in game six. The same guys got tired in game seven. They played incredible basketball for the first half, especially the first quarter in game six. They played pretty good basketball, or pretty damn good basketball for the first half of game seven. But, dude, how many people, you know, people need a break. And whether, I guess, D'Antoni didn't believe in the other guys or whatever, but the guys are going to get worn out. And they got worn out, which means you take crappier shots, you take worse shots, they don't go in. My other rip on D'Antoni was when Curry went on his little run there in the second half, I was looking at my buddy, I'm like, is he going to call a timeout? Like, we've seen that happen, or I should say, at least I've seen it happen a lot in the past couple of years, or actually since Curry's been a Golden State player, of when he gets hot, you got to call a timeout to kill it. And a hot three, and he hit back-to-backs, and you don't call timeouts. Like, are you making your guys sweat this one out? Are you thinking it's going to come to an end? Like, you've seen this play happen before. When Golden State gets hot and hits a couple of threes, you call a timeout. Especially at home, where the Golden State really can't feed off crowd and let people regroup. But he's like, I'm just going to keep letting them play. So those two things from D'Antoni's point to me were very puzzling. I mean, you could look back to how many ever games you've seen, Chris, of Golden State. When they get hot, you call timeout, especially with everything on the line. So that was a little bit puzzling. But to rip my own team, I don't know. There was no rhythm to that game. We won a game because we had two of the best shooters of all time with one of the best scorers of all time, and we made buckets when we had to, but that wasn't a beautiful basketball game from a Golden State standpoint at all. When Kerr walked off basically the court from the announcer interviewing him after the first quarter saying that was garbage basketball, like, that wasn't any sarcasm, or that was just basically that's garbage and walked away. Like, Kerr's normally a pretty good interview. He normally gives an answer, but the first quarter was embarrassing. The second quarter was slightly better, but we really haven't gotten into a rhythm, and it's kind of been that way for the playoffs. I don't know if KD has become a player that's made the offense different. Now, I'm not going to say that he hasn't benefited our team, because he has, but the rhythm
of
our offense.
Well, he had a great game, too.
He did. He finally had a good game, which was nice. Yes, it's a he stepped up and shot the ball well, hit some clutch shots, and I'll compliment him because I was tough on him for the past three.
A full great game, Marshall.
Yeah.
Finally,
a full
great game. He's had great. When you put up 27 or 28 in three quarters, you needed those points in the other games.
Yeah. It's just there was no fluidness to our offense for the whole game, and he's not a guy you just cast off. But there's a dynamic this year of our offense that doesn't look like teams looked like before, thankfully we have a skill level that basically is above anyone else to make up for it. But I've seen 10 times better basketball games, and just I don't know, there was no fluidness. I mean, maybe they're tired too. I mean, basically, besides LeBron, no, everyone else seems to kind of get tired. Same thing for Boston. I mean, yeah, they maybe Rozier and those guys aren't great shooters in the world, but still, an NBA player normally hits an open three. So, I'm thankful for Curry. Durant hit some nice clutch shots in the second half. Klay's always going to get you a couple buckets. I mean, you know, Draymond's never going to just mail it in. It was basically like a B performance. They got us the win. But I think that was definitely just a thankfulness of Houston being dog tired. And again, the reason I say that is maybe go against what I said earlier. The reason D'Antoni probably didn't play people is probably because they weren't that good enough to be in the scene. But I have seen guys, Chris, in the NBA where a coach will maybe put out a weaker player just for 3 to 4 minutes. Like basically, dude, your goal is not to screw up. Don't turn the ball over. Don't do something stupid. But you need to go on the court, try not to ruin things for us, and just give my guy time to rest. Maybe that's a thought that could have went through his head. Because, I mean, P.J. Tucker seemed to be playing, you know, balls out the whole game. And Ariza, they're ripping on him for being, you know, shooting poorly.
We got a Ryan Anderson sighting, so I don't know what you're talking about. We got a Ryan Anderson sighting. He played 8 minutes. We got a Joe Johnson sighting. We literally got a Joe Johnson sighting, dude.
I guess it's something, but it's not much. You know, I don't know. But at the end of the day,
that Marshall, well, it's easy to say that when you don't have your second best player on the court in Chris Paul.
Yeah. Well. Oh. Yeah.
Rip D'Antonio and what you're all talking about so much. First of all, the beginning of the series. Not many people actually would have put money on, you know, Houston to win it. They were not supposed to win the series. And then when you lose Chris Paul the last two games, it's really hard for me to rip in, besides just outside shooting that didn't fall. I definitely went over that. But it's really hard for me to rip the coach and any of the players, to be honest with you, when you did as good, you did pretty damn good without Chris Paul.
Oh yeah, I think the timeout thing is definitely rippable. I don't see why you wouldn't call a timeout, stop running home, and he basically did play seven guys the whole series. So I think you could have given more minutes out to people throughout all the games. I mean, through like games 3, 4, 5, those were all seven people deep, and that was it, even with Chris Paul. So I think maybe fatigue played a factor. I guess I'll just stick with that. But you could have. You normally don't see NBA teams only go seven deep strongly. So I think that the fatigue played a factor. So that's why I brought that up. I mean, obviously losing Paul hurts, but I mean you got to have a little more faith in the guys that ride your bench. I would hope, or I don't know, but yeah, the timeout thing.
It's
though,
easy
I think
to
that
say
was
that. But in a game seven. You play the shit out of your guys in a
yeah,
game seven.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
You do. I know, and it's hard to take out your best people because. But again, I do think the fatigue. Because again, that number we'll probably never see that again, Chris. Team missing that many threes in a row. Just 27. That's probably an NBA record. And I don't know if that's going to get broken anytime soon because those guys are incredibly talented athletes, especially a team like Houston who shot more threes this year than almost any team to ever play basketball. So, but. We got it done. It wasn't pretty. Again, this isn't the same Golden State team we've seen before, but they got it done. But my last comment on Houston is I will give them credit defensively. The defense they played in this series, I think, surprised many. Throughout this year, they've been basically a top 10 ranked defense by Sabermetrics of different stats in basketball. And I think that's something that people slowly started to realize, of this isn't just complete run and gun. This team can play D. And I think that the defense probably surprised Golden State too. That's probably part of the reason our offense didn't look as good as it could have, is because Houston played phenomenal defense. But again, when you're doing that, that wastes a lot of energy too. So, I mean, overall, fun series. I won't lie, I was pretty nervous when we were down, 15 points there in the first quarter, start of the second quarter. I'm like, dear God, is this really going to end this way? And, it ended up, some guys got hot and all that stuff. But now that leads us to deja vu number four. And Vegas has Golden State as a minus 1,000 to win the series. Most people are picking Golden State to win in four or five games. I don't think that's crazy. I think that's probably your most logical bet. Again, it's LeBron going against Golden State. This may be, I guess I'd have to be more of a Cavaliers fan, this maybe is the worst team he's had against Golden State. I know that second year he went against them was pretty, or one of them, I don't know. But anyways, like you said, it's we're just hitting the repeat button. Now, to compliment LeBron first, it's insane that a guy's now gone to eight straight ones. I was hearing some of the names of Varejo and Ogaskis and Booby Gibson, hearing the people that were on LeBron's first finals team when he started this run 8 years ago. They seemed like they were playing basketball it was 15 years ago. It doesn't seem that Anderson Varejao seems like such a mystery and a guy that was so long ago. And it's nah, dude, that's when LeBron started this run of eight in a row. And it's insane what he's done. Unfortunately, he's now going against a team where he's the best player on the court, but then he's playing against potentially four guys that are Hall of Famers. So, I think obviously if Cleveland gets Kevin Love back, that's huge. You need him back. I saw Iguodala's not out, not playing the first game. So from a Cleveland standpoint, you want Love back because he's a good player for you, or great player for you. Iguodala is out, and he's the guy that's defended LeBron the best. After that, I don't know where to go. LeBron could easily score 45 in this
series. He's out for game one. They haven't ruled him out for the series.
No. Yeah, Iguodala's out for game one. Yeah, sorry. I thought that's what I said. But yeah, he's out for game one. I would assume, hopefully, he'll be back for three or four. And that knee contusion must be a really deep bruise, but Iguodala is out, so that's a plus. Hopefully Love can come back from concussion protocol, but as we've learned in sports nowadays, you just never know. Everyone handles it differently. This isn't his first one either, so who knows what his stats is for game one. We've hit replay on this all the time. LeBron's going to do all that he can. They're going to try to slow the game down. They obviously don't want to get at a super fast pace. But you're going to have matchups where you got Jeff Green and Kyle Korver and Tristan Thompson on, Durant, Curry, Draymond Green, and Clay, and it's those bodies just don't match up. LeBron could have a phenomenal series. The Cavs could lose in six games, and you could give them all the confidence in the world, but I don't quite see how they're going to be able to get this done. This is a Cavs team that got pressed to the wall by Indiana and Boston, and now it's dude, now you're playing a team that's much better than them. I don't know what your game plan is. I don't know, Chris. Again, what new angles can you provide? Other than, I guess, the Golden State team hasn't quite looked as good against Houston, but Houston is a superior team than Cleveland. Barring injuries happening to Curry and Durant, I would assume this is a pretty easy series for Golden State. You got a better head coach, the better players besides LeBron. You got home court advantage. You got a deeper team. You got a better bench. If LeBron can pull this off somehow, some way, he could easily just walk off into the sunset and retire, because I don't think he could have a bigger achievement and find a way to win this series somehow, some way. I don't know what else to say, brother. It's the same thing, and it's even a bigger disadvantage than we've had in the prior three.
Yeah, I would actually, the only advantage I may be able to lean to Cleveland is the bench, actually. Because let's face it, your bench hasn't been that good lately. But that's not saying much.
Livingston's been good besides that, though. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Right, but you said the whole bench. You didn't say first guy off. I'm just saying they've had an issue. You know what I mean? They've had a little bit of an issue lately with that. But yeah, I mean, this is a non-final, you know? It's just a non-final. I mean, the way – and that's where I think Houston gets a ton of credit defensively. I think that's why there was a lot of hard looks for the key players, and they had to pass out of them, and sometimes the other guys didn't make them, you know, as far as Golden State-Houston. But I give a ton of credit to Houston just to push that thing. They really had no business going to Game 7. And like I said, I can't help to linger what would happen with Chris Paul at home in a Game 7, especially the way the flow was going already and what they would have needed to stay to kind of keep pace when they were making that run. But, I mean, how do you contain Golden State? You got to be rough and tumble. And then you just got to limit the looks that they get, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get them. You just got to – the problem is Cleveland and basically most teams aren't built that way. They're not really hard-nosed or scrappy. And when they are, it's just for chunks of games or a part of the series and whatnot. And what makes it hugely different – you know, last year we could say, oh, the style of play is going to be awesome, but – you know, like you said, I mean, with no Kyrie, and we don't really know what Kevin Love's going to show up, it just – it doesn't bode well. You know, as we know, the Western Conference was the finals. That finals was the finals. And everyone's kind of looking towards, like, trades and free agency just as much as they are, you know, this. And like I said, the saving grace last year was the style of play. It was very entertaining to watch and all that. But that's just not, I mean, the way this roster is assembled and then really reassembled, like I said, with the, we don't know what Love's going to bring because of the concussion. I don't know, man. It just.
Yeah. I mean, in fairness to Cleveland last year, they smoked Golden State Game 3. They humiliated them. And we were a pull up KD 3-pointer away from having the series tied at 2. That was kind of an entertaining series. The games weren't that bad, but Golden State has kept those people, and this is a weaker Cleveland team and not quite as a fast-paced one. See, I'm with you. Tyronn Lue could try everything he wanted, but, if you want to go fast with Golden State, they'll gladly play you fast. If you want to try to go big against them, then that puts you in such a massive hole on the defensive end because maybe you can crash the boards against Golden State, but how are your bigs going to cover their wing players? And it's just it's a tough system. I mean, now the people that say, well, this is boring NBA. We've had the same teams playing 4 years in a row for the title. Like, that sucks. Like, I've heard that mentioned a little bit. It's like, dude, that's honestly just a stupid take. I mean, LeBron is doing something that, as a sports fan, you have to love and acknowledge and realize you're witnessing one of the best players to ever.